Thanks for being with us tonight, everyone. We're in our final hour with Bill Scott. I'm George Knapp, in tonight for George Norrie. You know, where this book, Counterspace, The Next Hours of World War III, is pretty controversial. And in just a moment, we'll be opening the phone line so you can ask some questions of its co-author, Bill Scott. I want to ask one more question of him and then take a break and then go to the phones. Bill, you must be asked this all the time. Are you asked to back off? You know, I'm looking at the reviews of your book, and they're from all these guys in the Joint Chiefs and Air Force bigwigs, and I get the feeling, based on what you've written, that they approve that this message is getting out and it's moving in a positive direction. But at some point in your career as an aviation writer, somebody must have said, you're getting too close to this. Shut the heck up.
I can honestly say that I never had that from an official source, if you will. Nobody in a position of real authority has ever called me up and say, don't do that. I've been attacked numerous times from what I would call the working level. You know, I even had a neighbor at one time when I lived in California that jumped on me all the time. So you guys should not be writing about that stuff because you're giving the Russians in those days information. And I always took the approach that if I, as a reporter, having little or no resources to work with in terms of money,
espionage,
et cetera,
right,
and if we could come up with and find out about certain things, then I'm sure the KGB had found out about it a long time ago. And if they hadn't, and we were able to find out some of this stuff, then our own people in charge of keeping the secrets, the security folks, needed to close the gap. So either way, felt like we were not damaging national security. Now, of course, that's probably going to be subject to some discussion among others.
Absolutely, and I've been involved in those discussions myself over the years. You know, if in fact a reporter, a guy like you, sometimes me, can stumble on something or do a story that seems to be revealing some secret, then certainly somebody with the capabilities of the KGB could do it. And if we think we had a secret, well, in essence, the story would be doing us a favor by showing us that we don't.
Yeah, my observation over the years, George, I bet yours was too, was that usually many of these deep, dark secrets that people would go to almost any means to protect had not as much to do with national security in cases as they did with protecting somebody's rice bowl.
Oh, yeah.
In other words, some of the biggest blowback I ever received over certain stories were from the contractor community, because they were worried sick that if a lot of folks out there, including Congress, knew about a certain program, knew about the success or failures of such, they might lose money.
Well, I heard it directly from a congressional investigator who talked to me before he went out to Groom Lake. And he said, look, and he was looking into the Aurora stuff. It was at the height of those reports, and said it directly. If this turns out to be true, and if the more exotic explanation, the UFO stuff, turned out to be true, people are going to go to jail, which would give you a real good reason to keep stuff secret.
That's very good. Yeah, I ran into some senior military leaders that would look at things that I had written or that I asked them about and said, if we don't know about this, for instance, Black Star, you know, how can I, you know, in charge of the railroad, run the railroad if I don't know where all the cars and the engines are?
Right.
So it comes down to how much, you know, number one, is real, and number two, how much of the national security is served by super secrecy. I do know that during the first Gulf War, that the general in charge of the whole air war was approached by some of the folks that came out of the black community, and they said, hey, we've got these great things that'll really help you out. And that general had to say, go away. I don't have time to figure out how to integrate your new toy into my air war.
We're going to take a break, Bill. We'll go to the phones as soon as we come back. Stay with us for Coast to Coast AM. Bill Scott is with us. He is the co-author of Counterspace, The Next Hours of World War III. And as I mentioned earlier, Bill, I thought it reads a lot like a Tom Clancy book. They've made a lot of movies out of Tom Clancy books. Any talk about a film version of this one?
Yes. We sold a movie deal for the Space Wars book, the first one. And a movie is in process of being made right now.
And of course, you believe absolutely these Hollywood guys who tell you that any day now the movie will come out.
Not quite there yet.
Well, that's great news. One of our viewers, our listeners, had sent me this note. He wanted to know about the movie Patriot Games, a Tom Clancy movie, where they, you remember the scene where they reposition these satellites and they're watching real live action as commandos go in and wipe out these terrorist camps. How realistic?
I think that was a little over the top, especially for the time. Not sure we can do that sort of thing. If you stop and think about it, how do you keep a satellite over one spot long enough to keep watching it to that degree of resolution? Now, that being said, I do know that the resolution capabilities of our imaging satellites are pretty doggone good, but I think that might have been a little bit of a stretch, especially for that time when the movie came out.
Well, like Clancy, I guess like you, ahead of your time.
Well, but one of the nice things about fiction, and especially techno thrillers, is that you can explore how some of these advanced systems might be used, and then some of the surrounding issues, as I said, doctrine, policies, etc. How do they all fit into the overall big scheme of things? And we found, or I stumbled on this a few years ago, George, and I'm sure you have too, that as a reporter, we report the facts, but they're not necessarily as effective at moving or a society in a certain direction or changing perceptions. The fiction guys, the entertainment people, do a much better job of that. And you can even look at history. Some of the movies of the 50s and 60s, like On the Beach, Dr. Strangelove, they really brought home to the common person the horrors of nuclear war. And I think that had a lot to do with we as a society saying we really don't want to go there. Did it affect policies? Hard to say. But I have a feeling that it really raised the sensitivity to that sort of thing among everybody. And then one that we can really draw a real close link to is the China Syndrome. When that movie came out in 1979, and of course it was about a nuclear reactor going bad, right? Within 3 weeks, we had the Three Mile Island incident where a nuclear reactor did leak. Well, those two things together pretty much killed the nuclear power industry in this nation for right at 30 years now.
Well, I've had this kind of discussion with friends of mine who don't read novels, don't read fiction. They think it's a waste of time. They want to have nonfiction, factual stuff. And I've always made the position, defended the position that it's much more powerful. I mean, Uncle Tom's Cabin, Huckleberry Finn, those kinds of things can enact social change in a way that a straightforward report just can't.
Yeah, and we can actually point to some specifics. After Space Wars came out in April of 07 in hardback, and it was re-released last fall in October 08 in paperback, but just a few things that have happened since that time. I was asked to testify before a congressional panel about China's space program. Now, as a reporter for 22 years, I was never asked to do that thing. Write one fiction book, and they think you know a lot. And then, was asked to speak before people who really do this, quote, space stuff for real. Mike Camatos, my co-author, and I spoke to the 2007 Air and Space Leaders Symposium there in Las Vegas. And there were on the order of 30-some air attaches from around the world. So, again, a fictional story had an impact, and a lot of people want to know about it. National Security Space Institute here in town, it's really the space school. We've been asked to speak there. Some of the universities. We've also found out that the National Reconnaissance Office, these are the people that design, build, and run or operate the real, no kidding, spy satellites for this country. They had an off-site meeting a little over a year ago, and we learned secondhand that Space Wars, our first book, was required reading for that off-site. Well, these are the people that do it for real. But somehow, some way, the fiction and entertainment guys are having an impact, and hopefully raising some issues that may not have been looked at quite the same. And again, I think the way you can do that is a good story puts these issues in context where you can really see what the impacts might be on daily life or, in this case, national security.
I think Harrison Ford might be too old to play you. You should hold out for George Clooney, maybe. We're going to the phones. Wildcard line, Tom in Detroit. Hi, Tom.
How are you guys doing?
Hey, we're doing okay. What's on your mind?
Well, they just wrapped up the filming of Red Dawn, the remake of Red Dawn, and they've been here in the Detroit area for the past 5 months. They had Chinese paratroopers come in first, and they blew up a 747. Well, parts of 747s were all over town, my town here in Mount Clemens. And the scenario of the movie, I became friends with one of the grips, is the Chinese come in through an economic collapse first of the United States, where members of the government actually invite the Chinese to come in. And these teenagers form a group, the Wolverines, and we are the Wolverine State here in Michigan. They actually start a rebellion against the Chinese masters, our new masters. And if you go to Red Dawn 2010, you can see the whole scenario of the movie. And at first it seemed like a joke, but when we hear about how the Chinese have $700 billion of our dollars, and the scenario seems a possibility.
Is that, are you asking our guest? Are you asking Bill Scott if it's
I'm asking about the economic point of the, you know, of the movie, you know, that the Chinese sneak in, they come in, and they use their forces to oppress and put under, you know, the American people. And, you know, these teenagers, they're their only hope. That's according to the movie. But it's a really, to me, it seems like a possibility now, because I just read that, you know, Walmart opened up a store in China, and it's the first Walmart that has no imports.
I guess maybe the question, Bill, is whether or not the economic scenario plays a spot in your war games.
Yes, the economic factor is usually a big player in real-world war games. And I think what you've laid out there, Tom, is, you know, probably a little fantastical, if you will, in many ways. But there's no denying that China holding so much of our debt has a huge economic hammer hanging over us all the time. And then, you know, it's great grist for a fiction writer or a screenplay writer, because that is a real element. And then how you play that into other things like, you know, China coming in and actually taking over? Don't know. But that's the beauty of fiction and entertainment. You can explore a whole lot of possibilities. If nothing else, it raises the specter of China's power over us because of, you know, they hold so much of our debt. If we didn't have near as much debt, they wouldn't have near as much hold over us, right?
Thanks for the call, Tom. And, I suspect that if the Chinese did sort of take over Detroit, they'd regret it. It's not just, I mean, not just Detroit. That's a pretty tough town, but occupying America would be a pretty tall order. Our going to the east of the Rockies line, Jeff in Missouri. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning and Happy New Year's, I guess, considering the subject.
Almost.
I got a two-part question, if I can.
Okay.
To your guest, what is the possibility of us having these airship type carriers that can hold fighters on them? Are they a possibility?
Are you talking about these large flying triangles?
Yeah, not the triangles, more like they look like aircraft carriers, kind of. They could look like aircraft carriers, but they hold fighters and stuff.
And up in the air, I think is what you're saying.
Yeah. An airborne aircraft carrier.
That one, to me, as a flight test engineer, seems a little too far out. I don't know how you would do that. I guess the first question is, why would you do that? And over the years, you know, we've
all the weather phenomenon with all the weather and stuff with the hurricanes and stuff, and maybe safer.
I personally don't see how that could be safer. If anything, it would be probably more of a hazard. And again, maybe I'm not thinking quite far enough out there, but it looks to me like a few good air refueling tankers dragging along a, you know.
And I guess the other part of my question.
Fighters works just as well, and you can go around the hurricane.
And I guess the other part of my question is, excuse me, one is when will your books be made into a movie? And two, more serious question is, do we have actual spaceborne laser satellites in orbit?
The first one, yes, the Space Wars movie is in work right now. And the best of all worlds, that movie would be in theaters within a year, more likely close to 2 years before it's done. And, of course, it's not a done deal by any means. There are all kinds of things that have to happen before it's turned into film that we can go watch. But, yes, it is in work. The producers are serious about it, and it is moving along. As far as the spaceborne lasers, I think maybe we could do it in a very small fashion at this point. But the true space-based laser has been enacted as a real live, no kidding program a number of times, and then it's been killed, both for budgetary reasons, and it's a pretty doggone tough technological issue. It's hard to get enough power up there to really operate a high energy laser that would do what they would like it to do, which is, you know, actually be a weapon.
Thanks, Jeff. I think maybe he was edging toward asking something about almost like dirigible vehicles up there. You had mentioned something, I think the term was negative buoyancy. Is there any use for anything like an airship as a cargo carrier, something like that?
Yeah, most definitely. Near-neutral buoyancy airships. And again, you throw in that rigid hull aspect too. They can be pretty valuable. What I would theorize is that they would be ideal, perhaps, for inserting special operations forces behind the lines, because they can be pretty stealthy. They can move slowly, where radar might not pick them up, you know, even Doppler-type radar that senses motion. And you can carry quite a bit of men and equipment on it. So, yeah, it definitely has value out there. And there have been plenty of sightings of these large flying triangles that make you wonder if we don't already have some operational.
You know, we've sort of left the Russians out of this discussion. I have seen pictures of these gigantic dirigible-type things that the Russians have developed.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's always been a very attractive technological concept. One of the toughest things to deal with is they're pretty sensitive to the weather. So that's why this rigid hull aspect has probably come into being, because they actually develop some aerodynamic lift, and they're probably a little bit sturdier, can handle the turbulence and such a little bit better. But yeah, it wouldn't surprise me a bit if the Russians have been playing with that too.
I would imagine that it inspires, if they are floating around up there, it inspires a lot of UFO reports that come out.
Most definitely. And, you know, when I was reporting on these things, it wasn't unusual to have some of those UFO reports mixed up with these reports of the large flying triangles.
I want to ask you a little bit more about that, and we'll go back to the phones after this break here on Coast to Coast AM. We are in the home stretch with our guest, Bill Scott, co-author of the book Counterspace, The Next Hours of World War III. And when we come back, I want to go to the phone lines, get to as many of your questions as we can. But I also want to put Bill on the spot a little bit and ask him a UFO question. So don't go away. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We're in our final segment with Bill Scott, author of Counterspace, The Next Hours of World War III, going to our first-time caller line, Jason in Sacramento. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
Good morning.
Wanted to kind of make a comment. So you were talking about some of the experimental airplanes, and my grandfather worked at Edwards Air Force Base from the late 40s to the mid-70s. He worked on the X-1 and X-15, several other projects, too. And when he passed away, we had gone through a bunch of his documents, and he had a bunch of unclassified pictures and actually some movie footage of some of the test flights.
That's pretty cool. A lot of that stuff has been made public now, right?
Yeah, and the I completely lost my train of thought. I am so sorry.
Well, Jason, I'd just like to say hello to Sacramento, too. I'm a graduate of what we used to call Sac State there, Cal State University Sacramento. That's where I got my engineering degree. And I spent a lot of time at Edwards, so, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Some pretty fascinating programs out there. And if your grandfather worked on the X-1 and the X-15, he was right in the thick of some of the most fascinating times in U.S. aerospace development.
Thanks, Jason. East of the Rockies, John in Michigan. Good morning, John.
Hello, fellows. I appreciate you discussing these things tonight. I was on a flight one time from Detroit International Airport going out to Los Angeles, and we had to stop in Salt Lake City. And when we lifted off, the pilot said that there's a little bit of a weather problem that we're going to have to divert around, and so we banked right and went a little farther north. And I noticed while I was looking out the right side of the airplane, at about 30,000 feet or so, what appeared to me to be a baseball diamond. From just looking at it with my naked eye, I said, gee, that's an interesting-looking baseball diamond down there. And I realized that this valley was like 100 miles long, and it had one road running up it, and there was a construction of a baseball diamond, with, let's say, a building that was running from east to west that was about, it could be 100 yards thick and a mile or two long, and then a big sweeping building that went around, which would be the infield turn from first to second base and on over to third base. And so it looked like a baseball diamond with a landing airfield in the middle of it. And there was a section of it that was going down to home plate that disappeared in the ground. And I heard on a show here, I can't remember when, but it's been years ago now, that that's supposed to be Area 53, and I wanted to get a confirmation. Do you think that's where Area 53 is at?
Wow.
Boy, I can't answer that, John. I've never heard of Area 53. There may have been one as part of that nuclear test site complex out there. That's how Area 51 was designated. It was just one area of the MTS. I've done a lot of flying out there. When I was in the Air Force, we flew out of Hill Air Force Base and out over the Wendover ranges, the Utah test ranges, and on down near Dugway Proving Grounds. And I've seen a lot of complexes out there, bombing ranges, divert airfields and such. Never saw one that fit the description that you laid out there, though, a baseball diamond made up of the way the buildings were arranged. I honestly just can't answer that.
There is an Area 52. That's the Tonopah test range. And we do occasionally get reports that we can't confirm from people who people like John Lear, who think there are facilities out there that are basically camouflage that open up like a zipper and then go away. John, I appreciate the call. Just no way to confirm it. Bill, the UFO topic, I know it's uncomfortable for a lot of folks. And on this show, we explore a lot of interesting ideas that probably go beyond what you would cover in Aviation Week. You know, it's a crazy topic. There are wild theories. There are a lot of unsupported ideas. But there are pretty good researchers in this field who, you know, acknowledge that 90 or 95% of everything that's reported has a prosaic explanation. It's advanced planes, the kinds of things that you were talking about. And yet, in the circles that you travel, talking to military people, talking to aviation writers, I wonder if the topic comes up, and I'll put it in this framework, is that I travel in some of those same kind of circles, and people who would never write about it, would never talk about it on the record, elected officials, military, ex-military, and people who write for publications like yours, you get them in a bar and have an off-the-record conversation, and they will talk about unknowns. And I don't mean just unidentified, misidentified, but unknowns. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, I definitely think there are unknowns out there. And by definition, an unknown means we don't know what it is.
Right.
And then it comes down to the discussion of what could it be. You look at whatever data is available and try to come up with some reasonable explanation. I personally have never seen anything that convinces me, no hard data, that any of these unknowns are from another planet, another society, if you will, other beings. But I've always maintained that the scientific mind stays open to all possibilities until proven otherwise. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm a UFO believer.
Right.
It should not be a matter of belief. It should come down to a matter of what's the data, how do we interpret the data, and I stay open to all possibilities, as I said. But I also like to throw out, you know, other explanations. And the one that kind of keeps me, I think, grounded in all this is something that an engineer who worked at Groom Lake years ago told me. And he said, well, you know, if a hiker in the 80s was hiking in the Sierras and shortly after sunset he saw this black diamond-looking thing flying over him, he might very well think that it was a, quote, UFO from somewhere else, when in fact it was an F-117 Nighthawk. Pretty radical design of the times, right? We
yep.
didn't know we had anything like that out there. But he said, we have means of covering that up if it gets into the media. And I said, you mean the UFO phenomenon? And he smiled and said, it's worked well for 50 years. Why would we change now? So when we as reporters bump into these things, there may be a kernel of truth in there, but it may be wrapped in an awful lot of nonsense, too. So it's tough to peel away the nonsense to find what's the kernel of truth. And believe me, it is a hall of mirrors, as you know. I always say that chasing black world airplanes or unknowns of any sort is kind of like trying to herd smoke into a jar. It's real hard to do.
Yeah, you know, that use of UFOs to sort of cloud the issue of exotic planes or secret planes, that it's a two-edged sword, you know. It also works to cloud what truly are unknowns. And I was just wondering if you ever, in an off-the-record conversation with military guys or people who know about this stuff, have, you know, a heart-to-heart where they say, man, there was something really weird floating over the base, or something popped up on the radar, or anything like that.
Oh, yeah. I've run into that any number of times. That, you know, the bottom line is we just don't know what it was.
Right.
And there's some fascinating anecdotes out there, but I have yet to find enough hard data to pin down what those things were. And until we can do that, then I think we're just guessing, really.
Fair enough. I mean, having the open mind as a writer of your stature, that's all you can ask for. Back to the phones, Wildcard Line, Bobby in New York. Good morning, Bobby.
Good morning, George and Bill. I'll be real quick. A few weeks ago, there was some type of spiral light event, I believe, over Norway, and Russia said it was a failed missile attempt. I just wanted to know what your take on it was.
Well, Bobby, I think that that's exactly what it was. If you look right along the line of flight of a missile, and if for some reason it was not flying in a straight line, you know, if it had one thruster that was acting wrong, a spiral would be one of its possible actions there. So, and then you get the low sun angle, the right atmospheric conditions could create that spiral. And if you were to run around 90 degrees to it and look at it from, you know, from one of the other directions, it may have looked totally different. It may have looked just like a wiggly contrail.
Good enough, Bobby. Thanks. Wildcard Jerry in Arkansas. Good morning, Jerry.
And George, morning, Bill. Fascinating program. I had two questions, but George just asked you the one about the UFO, so I'll get to my second one real quick. And if you've answered this, I apologize. I've been in and out of the truck all night. Might have missed it. Do we have technology to fly anti-gravity, to your knowledge?
Not that I know of. Back in the 50s, the government had a number of contractors looking into things that they called electrogravitics at the time. So it was using electromagnetics to try to interface with gravity somehow. And, you know, it could be anti-gravity, but some means of controlling gravity. As of today, I'm not aware of anything that worked. Going back to what George and I have been saying all night, though, we always leave open the possibility that we may have had a breakthrough. It's in the black world, extremely classified, and we just flat don't know about it. But as far as I know, we haven't really solved that problem of how do we reduce gravity or create anti-gravity.
Boy, the term negative buoyancy sure comes close to anti-gravity, doesn't it?
Well, that's really just canceling the effects of gravity using gas more than anything else.
Jerry, go ahead.
I was going to ask him one other thing. If he had ever heard of the SERPO project, the supposed change for American astronauts for alien astronauts, and I'll take my answer off there. Good show, guys.
Thanks.
Nope, never heard of that one.
Well, I've heard of it, and I think it's a bunch of baloney. Thanks, Jerry. Wildcard Frank in Wisconsin. Hi, Frank.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wondered if your guest ever thought of the scenario where things get pretty hairy. You know, you don't have a lot of time to waste in Washington. Would the military ever consider declaring Congress and the presidency irrelevant and take it over? They seem to make better decisions than our president does.
Well, having been an Air Force officer, Frank, it's pretty well hammered into every military person that the civilians are in control, that the military does not act on its own. It is our job, our military job, to carry out the policies of the politicians. And we like to think that there are enough checks and balances in Washington to where things don't get carried away. Now, that said, do know that during the Cold War, there were quite a number of cases where the politicians maybe got out of off the reservation a little bit, and it was the cool heads, both in the Soviet Union of the day and in the U.S., that said, let's stop and think about this very carefully, and time and again, probably averted all-out war. So it's not that they countermanded or took over the political process or went against the politicians, but they were the voice of reason many, many times, and I think that's a much better position for our military folks to be in.
I saw the movie 13 Days in October about the Cuban Missile Crisis the other day, and it sure made the military guys look like the ones that wanted to go to war and the civilians the ones with the cool heads.
That gets back to the entertainment problem, is that unfortunately, the military people and aerospace community that I came from, we've pretty much let the entertainment community define us. And there was another thing we said with our books is we would like to try to improve the image of aerospace engineers and scientists and test pilots and the military, because believe it or not, there's some pretty smart folks in those crowds, and we're not all knuckle-dragging Neanderthals.
Well, thank goodness for that. Next, you're going to tell me that Dr. Strangelove was completely fictional.
Strangelove was pretty scary, wasn't it?
It was hilarious, though. East of the Rockies, John in North Dakota. Good morning, John.
Hey, George. Hey, Bill. I got Bill, what's your opinion and perception on the movie Enemy of the State and Behind Enemy Lines, with the satellites and also with the download, when Will Smith was in the building and they did a wireframe download? What do you think of that?
Meaning the capabilities for domestic surveillance and things of that sort?
Yeah.
I think the capabilities, to a degree, are probably there. Don't think they're near as good as Hollywood would like to depict. Again, I worked at the National Security Agency as a brand new lieutenant, and was also a brand new electrical engineer. And my job was space communication security. So we touched on some of those capabilities. I was amazed at what we could do, and this was in the early 70s. But I was also I understood the things we could not do. And believe it or not, physics still rules out there. You can only get so much out of light and lenses and that sort of thing. So Hollywood likes to show, you know, the TV show 24 says they can do all kinds of fantastic things. But have you ever noticed that on 24, it doesn't matter where they are, the cell phones work? And do yours work everywhere?
I mean, not in my house.
Do they work in your house? Do they work inside concrete and steel buildings, in the parking lots under the buildings? But they always do on TV, right? Well, that's prerogative of the storyteller. And it's not important that they get all the technology exactly right. They're trying to move a story ahead in a very short time there. But to answer your question, John, I don't think we're at that stage. If we are, count me wrong.
Thanks for the call, John. We're going to go to our first-time caller line. Robert, we got about a minute, so get right to it.
Yes, I was wondering what you thought about if the Americans were going to China, or Americans were committing attacks on Lockheed, I guess it was called, the FBI called it Titan Rain a while back. And what if they were, Americans were going through a proxy to go to China and then come back to the U.S. to do cyber attacks?
Sounds like a great fictional scenario to me. I don't know anything more than that about it.
Thanks for the call, Robert. Bill, what happens next? Do you write a sequel to this book?
We've been asked that. Will there be a, what we call Space Wars 3? There may be. We would probably move it out to about 2025. But more than likely, we would switch to a new series. We would have some of the same characters and move it into something we call Atlas Attacks. And that's a series that's pretty much counterterrorism using non-lethal technologies. And it's no longer nation states. It's a bunch of international conglomerates, multinational companies that decide terrorism is bad for business, and they take on the terrorists themselves.
Wow, I'm not sure who I'd root for in that scenario. Bill Scott, thanks very much. Good luck with the book, Counterspace, The Next Hours of World War III. Thanks, everyone, for being with us. I'll be back next month, and thank you, and hope you have a happy new year. Good night.